I'm David Marcus, host of Drinks with the Deal, and today our guest is Matt Simpson, a private equity partner at Mintz Levin in Washington. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Hey, David. Thanks so much for having me. Really excited to be here.
We're going to talk about several things on today's podcast. First of all, your background and how you transitioned from international negotiation to corporate work. Secondly, reps and warranties insurance. Third, co-investments and the issues they raise. And then finally, your love of sailing. So with that, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how you ended up in corporate law.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, David. Well, my path has not exactly been linear. I think many of us in the legal industry are programmed to follow a specific path from undergrad to law school, straight into summer associate positions, and then first year positions as well. And while I did all of those things, I didn't necessarily do them all in the same order that other people do. And I've been really fortunate to have opportunities along my career path that were both mentally stimulating and challenging and pushed me outside of my comfort zone in many ways. And varied. And that really appeals to who I am and my attention span and how I like to think of things. And so, you know, not to go too far back, in undergrad, I was south of the border here. I'm originally from Toronto up in Canada, and I was a sailor and I grew up sailing there. And I know we'll end with the sailing, but I raced competitively, and Hobart and William Smith Colleges at the time was one of the top sailing programs in the country. So I found myself racing there, and it was post NAFTA, early 2000s, and I was really enjoying some of the Canada-US banter that was going around, and was NAFTA a good thing or not. And so I focused a little bit on international trade law in undergrad. And ultimately, that led me down to Washington, D.C. for grad school, where I joined American University and the Center for North American Studies. There was a man named Bob Pastor who was running the Center for North American Studies. And I really got to roll up my sleeves in a dual degree program with my law degree and my master's doing international trade work. And that was a lot of fun and interested me. I actually started the International Trade Law Society at American University, which very quickly grew to be the largest organization on campus, and to this day is still very successful there. And in doing that, I got connected with a professor at American named Paul Williams, and he ran an organization named the Public International Law and Policy Group. And Paul said, "Hey, Matt, you have some experience with international trade. I've got some guys in Northern Cyprus that might want to talk to you about some trade issues." And so I flew out to Northern Cyprus as a second year law student and sat down with them, and they said, "Well, forget about that. We're actually done with the trade issue, but we do want to file a complaint at the European Court of Human Rights." And so I spent the next week in Lefkosia working with Northern Cypriots on filing a European Court of Human Rights complaint. And it was the first experience where I really got pulled out of my comfort zone, and also my first entree into international law in that way, international development. And so I came back and I continued to work with PILPG and Paul. We worked on Iraq's 2007 constitutional amendments. We worked on Kosovo and Montenegro and various other projects. And at one point, a group of Darfuris and the U.S. Institute of Peace called us up and said, "Hey, we're thinking of negotiating a peace agreement. The African Union and the UN have called and want to host something in Doha. Could you guys work with us? And could you help advise us on how to train Darfuris and train the diaspora on how to negotiate a peace process?"
And you were still in law school at this point, or you had gone to private practice?
I was still in law school at the time. And it was a great program and a partnership that PILPG had with American University, where we got to do work with PILPG almost as an externship program while still continuing to go to law school. And my 3L year, I spent the better part of the spring semester working with the Darfuris and teaching them and working with them on negotiation skills. We were supported by Baker & McKenzie, a great team globally from Baker & McKenzie that helped us, hosted us, in fact, in London, Paris, Brussels, New York, DC. We were traveling all over the world meeting with these Darfuris. And then I had the fortunate opportunity to join Weil Gotshal after my 3L year. I had summered there the year before, and I joined their DC office in their trade group. Again, my focus was on international trade law at the time. And Weil was incredibly supportive of my work with PILPG. I brought them on as a pro bono client my first week at Weil, which also happened to be the week that Lehman Brothers went down. You know, my first day was September 10th, 2008. So it was a very interesting time to be at Weil. And everybody that wasn't busy suddenly became a bankruptcy lawyer and worked on the Lehman bankruptcy. And it just fantastic lawyering at the time. Now, fortunately for me, I was very busy working on softwood lumber and working with the fantastic trade group that Weil had. I was led by Joanne Osendarp, who was one of the top Canadian trade lawyers. And she was the reason I had originally joined Weil. They had Chip Rowe, Jeannie Anderson from the American side, and then Guillermo Aguilar Alvarez from NAFTA. So we had our own little NAFTA group at Weil.
So you said softwood lumber. Tell us a little bit about softwood lumber.
Yeah, so it's one of the largest trade disputes in history between two really good friends, Canada and the US. But there were a lot of, and there continues to be, although I admit I'm not nearly as current, but there has been a lot of discord in that industry about how and when the Canadians in particular are or are not dumping lumber into the US, so anti-dumping investigations, and subsidizing their forestry industries. And Canada is very federalist in many respects, and one of the ways that they are is that each of the provinces owns their natural resources. And so it wasn't just against the government of Canada, it was actually against Ontario and Quebec and British Columbia. And the Maritimes were also involved. And so as a Canadian living in DC, wanting to do trade law, Weil was a fantastic place for me to land because we represented the government of Canada. And it felt really good to be representing my home country in these major disputes. I mean, there were billions of dollars at stake and jobs and forestry industries. And it has been litigated and disputed and multiple treaties and agreements have been signed over the years. But at the time, we were working at two particular arbitrations in front of the London Court of Arbitration. I think somebody once said there were 17 law firms in DC alone working on that one dispute. It was involved, and it was some of the best legal minds that I've ever worked with. You know, the brief writing, the investigation work. And at the same time that I was doing that work, I was also doing a little bit of export control advice on the deal processes. And so I got to work with Weil's fantastic private equity deal team, but as an export control regulatory lawyer advising on some of those deals. And that was originally my first exposure to deal making and the M&A side of life. But while I was at Weil and in the middle of the softwood lumber disputes, I got a phone call from the African Union and the United Nations. And they said, hey, so those Darfuris that you'd spent the last 3 or 4 years working with on negotiating a peace agreement, well, they're ready to negotiate, but they don't want to start until you guys get over here. So get over to Doha, which as a second year associate was a little bit of a tricky conversation to have with management at Weil. But to their credit, they were phenomenally supportive. And I spent a couple I think I did 2 or 3 trips while I was at Weil to the peace talks in Doha to help the Darfuris ramp up. And then they basically acknowledged that the process was beginning full speed and that they wanted me over there full time. So I made the very difficult decision. Again, this is post-2008. It was 2010 or 11 at the time. It was a tough time to be in a law firm. The legal industry was struggling, obviously. Weil was doing incredibly well, though. And I had a great job working with really great people. And I quit. And some told me I was crazy and some said, this is just a terrible, why on earth would you leave Weil at this great time? And I'll never forget one of the senior partners, Chip Rowe, pulled me aside and he said, look, Matt, I know plenty of 60-year-olds that have never done anything nearly as interesting as the peace process. Go do it. You'll figure out the money later. And so I went and fundraised my salary from a high net worth individual. And I spent the next 2 years living with the Darfuris in Doha and being one of the official members of the Darfuri delegation negotiating the peace agreement.
And so how did you transition from that experience to a corporate work? How come you didn't go back to international trade work?
Well, I think for two reasons. One, as an export control lawyer, I got to see what it was like on the other side of the fence. I got to see these M&A lawyers who, yeah, they weren't sleeping much, but man, were they having fun negotiating these deals. And it was true negotiation. And they were in the weeds. And they were making deals happen. And that was an initial glimpse into that world. And secondly, as in the peace process, I was there to negotiate. My job was to quarterback. I was not a substantive expert in any one of the particular areas. We had experts on Truth and Reconciliation commissions. We had experts on IDP and refugee return. We had experts on natural resources sharing. My job was to coordinate. My job was to quarterback and to be a strategic advisor to the Darfuri leadership as they thought about all these issues and to help them negotiate it against the government of Sudan and frankly, against the Western governments that were sponsoring the peace talks as well. I've spent a lot of time with the US, with the Canadians, with the Brits. And I realized that I really enjoyed deal making. Fundamentally, at its core, the peace process was just a deal that got negotiated. There was paper memorializing that deal. But it was deal making. And so when the process ended, and frankly, it ended poorly, we advised our clients not to sign the peace agreement. And two of the three major rebel groups did not sign it. One rebel group did. And it struggled to be implemented for many years thereafter. But when I left that process, I realized that the M&A guys were having a lot of fun, that fundamentally, I liked negotiations and I liked deal making. I liked building something and I liked that quarterback role. And so I got connected with the recruiter and my instructions were, I want to look at a corporate practice. I want to make the transition and I want to go become a corporate lawyer. And so she's the one that introduced me to Torrey's. And being a Canadian lawyer, you know, or a Canadian, I studied in the US, but she called me up and said, hey, do you know these guys at Torrey's? And I said, yeah, it's a fantastic firm. I know it well. And I found myself there shortly thereafter for the next couple of years working on private equity M&A, mostly for the Canadian pension plans that were off on a shopping spree in the US and globally, but advising folks like CPPIB, Teachers, AIMCO on a lot of their US deal activity.
And then how did you make the transition to Washington and to a more middle market practice?
Well, that came about for two reasons. I mean, largely, I get to blame my wife for that one. When I was up at Hobart in college, I met this beautiful curly-haired blonde that was far smarter than I was. And we're now going on almost 19 years together. And so she and I had moved to DC when we went to law school. We both went to American and had stayed in DC through while and through the Darfur process. And she was a presidential management fellow and had a job at USAID in the State Department. She worked with Secretary Clinton on a few interesting projects, as well as at the Office of Management for USAID. And so she had stayed in DC while I was up at Torrey's in New York. And the distance was not fun. We got to know the train routes really well, but otherwise it was pretty tough. And so when I realized that her job, she was doing really well, climbing the ladder quite quickly, we decided to relocate back to DC. So I ended up leaving Torrey's, and my assistant at Torrey's happened to be the assistant for the Mintz Levin managing partner in DC 15 years prior. And she said, oh, you're moving back to DC. You've got to go meet Susan Burson. She's great. I love her to death. And she manages Mintz's DC office. And so I had heard of Mintz, but most of the deals I'd been doing at Torrey's and certainly the ones that I'd seen at Weill were large cap deals. And I started thinking a little bit about, more about what it was to be a middle market lawyer and how Mintz was positioned in the market. And I went to Susan and we hit it off instantly. First of all, she understood my nonlinear career path. It was really hard at times to be meeting with some of the larger firms in particular and to go to them and say, well, I started as a trade lawyer who did a little bit of export control compliance, who negotiated a peace agreement, who spent a couple of years doing private equity M&A, and now wants to firmly cement himself in the private equity M&A world. It was hard. And she seemed to get it. And that's part of Mintz's culture is they're entrepreneurial. They think outside the box. And so she and I really hit it off. There's an opportunity to grow a corporate practice out of DC that really appealed to me and to be client facing in a way that I really enjoy. I always knew my future was never as the guy who had his head in the books and was tweaking the documents. And that's the piece of the job that I loved the most. I like clients. I like the problems that we solve. I like being that strategic advisor. And the opportunities at Mintz were just a perfect fit for that. And a key piece of that was the middle market. You know, one of the things I love about my job now at Mintz is that we're deliberately middle market. The deals that we do are the $30 to $50 million up to $500 million sell side and buy side private equity. That's where our private equity practice is focused. And we've all done those larger deals. Many of us have come from other firms where we were doing larger deals. But the middle market, to me, is a completely different beast. And I love doing those deals there in part because you're dealing with real people in a different way than I had before. The seller in that transaction is usually somebody that had a really cool idea for a widget, worked their tail off, built a business. Sometimes they're family-run businesses for 30 or 40 years, and this is achieving their life's work. Other times it's an entrepreneur that had a really good idea, brought in some venture money, but is at an inflection point where they know that they need growth capital. They know that they need somebody to come in and help them take it to the next level. And yeah, take some money off the table. And so when you buy those businesses, there are different judgment calls that you have to make than when I was doing the large cap deals. The guy who came up with the widget, I'm sure it's a great widget, right? My clients have all vetted the technology by the time they call me usually. But odds are good, they probably weren't great on GDPR compliance, or they didn't really think through all the worker classification issues they needed to. Maybe they don't even have an employee handbook. And so you spend a lot of time advising your clients, not just on the technical legal aspects of a purchase agreement and how to structure these deals, but on the judgment calls that they have to make and the risk allocation. And how do we think about this deal? And what is the magnitude of this risk? Can we put it into a box? It is true deal making, because every deal I've done, there has been a problem in that deal that probably should have killed it at one point or another and would have killed it. But I've also never seen a deal that can't be done. Every deal I've seen can get done. It all just depends on your risk tolerances and how you allocate them. And I've walked on plenty of deals, both on the sell and the buy side, because we've decided that that's just not the right risk tolerance for us. But ultimately, my job as a strategic advisor to these clients, as they're selling their businesses or buying somebody else's business, is to help them think through those risks. And they're real world risks, and they're problems created by real people, usually. And very rarely is it a deliberate, oh, I intentionally stuck my head in the sand. It's just I didn't have the bandwidth, right? I'm running this business. I've got a lean staff. I need you to help me grow it. And yeah, sure. Let's spend a bunch of time on my data privacy once you come on board. It's just not great yet. And that's okay, right? That's the acceptance. And you got to go in there, especially in this business where there's a lot of rollover, and you've got to zealously represent your buyer. You got to zealously represent your client, figure out where all the problems are. But you got to do it in a way that's commercial, in a way that doesn't really piss off the other side. Because the last thing you want to do is have a CEO that just sold you his business, continues to have a 40% interest in it, is now running the business, and turn around and have him be really pissed off at you for being a jerk. And that's, in fact, where rep and warranty insurance really comes in, and my love of that industry and that practice, because that's a really helpful tool in the middle market in particular.
So you do work both for rep and warranty insurers and obviously for private equity firms that are buying businesses and using reps and warranties insurance to help manage risk. Talk about each of those perspectives and how your work for the insurers influences how you advise private equity clients, not just on reps and warranties insurance, but on the purchase of a business more broadly.
Yeah, sure. So I think I love the fact that I get to work with on both sides of that iron curtain. I represent buyers as they're buying companies, doing the diligence and procuring the rep warranty insurance. And we also represent underwriters as they're looking at these transactions and underwriting the insurance risk. And I think having the insights into how insurers think about this product, how they think about risk, has been really helpful to our buy side practice. I mean, that industry is very competitive, very proprietary in terms of how each of the underwriters think about how they approach things. But it keeps us focused on what ultimately matters, right? Rep and warranty and underwriters are in the business of taking risk. They will take risk. That's their job. And so what their exercise when an underwriter is looking at an insurance product for a transaction, they're really looking for a couple of things. One is the buyer negotiating this at arm's length. Is this some sort of deal where they're in the pocket and the buyer's sort of cutting corners and getting insurance to cover off some unnecessary risk? The second thing that they're looking for is the seller reasonably disclosing? You know, when we look at disclosure schedules, because the insurers are only insuring risk for a breach of a rep. And if there's no breach of a rep because something was disclosed, then the insurers don't care. But obviously, there's a practice in the industry where, well, perhaps not obviously, but some would suggest there's a practice in the industry where sellers may be disclosing a little bit less than they otherwise would when insurance is involved, because the risk of a breach is not on them, it's on the insurer. And so from the underwriting perspective, we try and spot that. And then thirdly, they're saying, is the buyer doing reasonable diligence? The exercise is not to go do primary diligence as underwriter. It's to go diligence the diligence and to look at it and say, all right, is this buyer's counsel and is this buyer generally looking at all the things we would expect them to look at? That doesn't mean they're not making judgment calls. And that's where I think on the buy side, our experience is really valuable with our underwriters, because the underwriters know and expect you to be making judgment calls. If you have one customer in the UK that was referred to you by an existing customer and you have no real physical presence and your total sales out of the UK are less than 1%, you may well make a judgment call that you don't need to go do GDPR diligence. The underwriters are going to want to understand why you have a UK presence but haven't done any diligence in the UK. And that's where we get on the phone with the underwriters' counsel and say, and the underwriters, in the underwriting call or even in follow-ups, and say, look, this is the fact pattern. This is the company we're buying. This is why we think that the risk is really immaterial there. It's just not something that we should care about and therefore not something you should care about. And those are the judgment calls that we can make. I think it also gives us a lot of credibility when we're on the buy side, because we know so many of the underwriters and we know the space so well that they know we're not going to stuff them with unreasonable, unnecessary risk. There are people in the market right now that are pushing the insurance market to cover more and more things. We're seeing synthetic reps where they're asking underwriters to write reps into a policy that don't even exist in the agreement. The frontier is fascinating in the insurance space and the transactional space right now, just how it's building out and all the different places it's going. But some of that's dangerous. They're pushing the market in a way where we're going to see more claims and we're going to see even higher level claims. And so the underwriters, I think we have a fair bit of credibility with a lot of them, in part because we will bring to them transactions that are well diligenced, that are thought about, and we know where the policy should generally end up. And if there's going to be exclusions, we know roughly what they're going to look like. And we anticipate that for our clients. And I just closed a deal not that long ago for a buyer where we knew there was some IP risk. And we knew because of the underwriters and how they thought about IP risk that we're going to get an exclusion. And so rather than trying to play a game and stuff the insurer with it and find ourselves 4 weeks later with a giant exclusion that was going to be a huge hole in our policy, we deliberately worked with the seller from the beginning on a special indemnity for that issue. And we were very transparent. We were very clear with them. And it meant the process went far smoother than it otherwise could have. It was much faster. It was much more efficient because we were clear. We said, there's no way we're going to get that past the underwriters. They're going to see it. They're going to see it as an issue. And so we designed our transaction in a way to be thoughtful about where we were going to end up on the insurance. And it ended up working really well for both our client, for the underwriters. It made for a smooth process.
Talk a little bit about co-investments and the issues you see there, either in advising the private equity firm, you know, selling a piece of a business, or in advising a family office, say, in co-invest.
Yeah, sure. So it's the most interesting thing about co-investments to me right now is just how many more of them we're seeing, the real uptick in co-investments. And I think there's two reasons for that. I mean, one of them is the obvious. It reduces the equity check for the sponsor, right? It brings other capital in, and that's beneficial for two reasons. One, you know, I don't think you can do a podcast these days and not mention a SPAC, right? It just sort of seems like we have to mention SPACs at some point. So here you go. We've mentioned SPACs. SPACs are driving equity prices up. Everybody knows that. Or people that have spent a lot more time thinking about that than me. But generally speaking, in the last year and a half, we've seen SPACs driving up equity prices a little bit. We certainly see them in auctions and bidding on deals. And so as equity prices creep up, you're suddenly seeing, especially in the middle market, sponsors that were comfortable with the $30 million equity check that are now looking at a $40 or a $50 million equity check. And so as prices climb, the opportunity to bring in co-investors allows folks, family offices and others and funds and independent sponsors, which we also represent, to play in a process that they might not otherwise would have. And it's so incredibly competitive out there right now that allows them to upsize and play in a different space. It also allows the sponsor to distribute its dry powder around a little bit more evenly. It de-risks any one investment by freeing up some dry powder to go and possibly put it in another place. So I think that's one of the key reasons in terms of the equity check size. And then another, arguably even more important reason, is to reward preferred relationships. I mean, fundraising has been record, right? And folks are sitting on a lot of dry powder and there's a lot of pressure to deploy capital. It's been hard in the last year for everybody to keep, you know, the supply of targets to keep up with the demand. Again, the SPAC market can be blamed for some of that, but not all of it. And so you've got LPs that are saying, look, I want to deploy capital and I put a bunch of money into you, but I'm sitting on my own dry powder. Let's talk about opportunities. And so it allows you to reward those preferred relationships, and oftentimes with less or no economics. It allows them to come in without the fee, without the carry, and without a lot of additional transaction costs for the LP. So it's great access, and they don't have to do all the work they might otherwise have to do to source and lead their own direct investment. So that's why we're seeing a lot more of it. And in the family office, in the middle market space, we're certainly seeing that, those characteristics driving a lot of the deals. Now, the consequences for the sponsors and our clients that are leading those deals, obviously, you're losing some of the economics, and that's no fun. Folks don't like to give up the fee or the carry. You're seeing a bit more on the transaction cost side. It's complicated. You know, it's something that we have to socialize often with the sellers in a process. It's, oh, no, you're not just being bought out by this Wall Street billionaire. You're being bought out by him, and he's bringing in a couple other family offices. But don't worry about that. That's all behind the curtain, right? Sometimes you get away with that. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have to share a little bit more information on who the co-invest syndicate is and sort of where that equity check's coming from. And then you have to negotiate a whole new structure. I mean, fortunately at Mintz, we've got a really strong funds practice and a co-invest practice as well that I lean on extensively now in a way in the last 2 years that I hadn't previously to help me set up those aggregator vehicles and bring folks into the process. One of the interesting trends I would comment on, and I was talking with a colleague about this yesterday, is intuitively, you would think that when these LPs that are often in the fund already come in directly into a vehicle, you're giving up a lot more rights. I mean, we talked about the economics a little bit, but that you're giving a lot more in terms of information rights or access rights or protective provisions. And sometimes we do see that when the co-investor's coming in and taking up a significant portion of the equity check. But usually, it's just not the case. We're not seeing them push more aggressive. I would have expected, and I would think they might push more aggressively for rights in the lower tier structure when they co-invest. And we're just not seeing it. Obviously, they care about disclosure. They want to, especially some of the public money. They're really concerned about the sort of exceptions to confidentiality restrictions and that sort of stuff. But we're just not seeing a lot more investor rights go out the door. It's not that cumbersome as you might intuitively think that it would be. Usually they're investing alongside a fund where they've already got some skin in the game, and they're usually pretty happy just to sit back and take, you know, the ability to upsize their check economic free, you know, free and carry free. So I think that's one of the features that we're seeing that may change, but I think with so much dry powder in the market right now, these guys are just happy to deploy capital, and those opportunities are presenting themselves more and more frequently.
And then finally, sailing, which we talked a little bit about at the beginning of the podcast, brought you to Hobart and in some ways started you on your life path. How do you indulge that interest today?
Well, I very much love sailing. This job doesn't necessarily lend well to me hopping on the boat and going out on a random Tuesday night for beer can racing, but I still try and touch the world as much as I can. I mean, first of all, with Tokyo 2020 just ending, it was so much fun to watch. I have a 5.5-year-old and she knows she's part Canadian and part American. And so that's always fun when the Olympics roll around, where her allegiances lie. But we sat down and watched some of the sailing, and there's been a few new events at the Olympics that were a little bit more high speed, high adrenaline. They've got some of the skiffs and the foiling boats in there. And we just had so much fun talking about the sailing. It's also a sport where the women and the men get equal, at least in the Olympics right now, are largely getting equal television time and attention, and women competing against women. And so as a dad raising a daughter, that's really cool to me. It's empowering. And then our summer vacation for the last couple of years, our COVID safe summer vacation, has been to charter a boat out of Annapolis. We love being out on the water. And so the last 2 years, we've spent at least a week on the boat, putzing around the Eastern Shore. And it's just so much fun because we can find our way up a river and on the Eastern Shore of Maryland and find a spot that looks cool, drop the anchor, go for a swim, cook some hot dogs, and watch the bald eagles fly over. And it's just been a really great, you know, opportunity to spend real quality family time, but also indulge my hobby and my love for being out on the water. The boats, you know, my wife will accuse me of trying to make a 45-foot catamaran go faster than it should. I'm always trimming the sails, and it's kind of hard for me to get into cruising mode as somebody that was built to race. But I'm working on that, and we still have a lot of fun, and it's a family passion that we can all do together.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
It's really been my pleasure. Thanks so much, David. It's been great chatting with you.
For Drinks with the Deal, I'm David Marcus.